Session number 14806.
Really, Murray side too. So you're on this civilian train, yes?
And gradually, of course, it got hotter and hotter in there. And there was an awful smell permeating the atmosphere.
And you're on your own in this little compartment?
On my own. Yes. And I'm sure there were room for six or eight passengers. And it wasn't a compartment. It wasn't a corridor train or anything.
No.
It was just this, as the, you know, that's what they were in those days. And you read in the book a story about those. No, that was a passenger train and a corridor train coming from Switzerland. But on this occasion there. And there's awful smell. I felt, you know, there was something dead. And I looked all round, but of course there was hardly anywhere to look. There was the wooden roof rack with, wooden rack up there, roof rack, with just slats. And there were the seats were just slats, and the metal pillars supporting the seat and supporting everything. No way could there have been anything in there that I couldn't find. And eventually, of course, my nose got back to my bag. And
that?
I opened the bag, and there was this round box like this, which was stinking to high heavens. And so I threw it out of the window. How many times afterwards did I remember that camembert cheese?
Oh, dear.
No, and so that was the camembert. Now then, why I feel sure, absolutely certain, was that the door was locked and that there was nobody else in the compartment and that it was going direct to Toul. It might have stopped on the way. Mm. See, but eventually when we landed at Toul, there on the platform was a sergeant, he had three stripes, of the Legion. I recognized the uniform, in summer uniform, light khaki, and two legionnaires with bayonets. And the sergeant himself had a pistol in his belt, you see. And they waited, and they were just, my compartment landed exactly opposite them, and he opened the door, whether with a key or not, I don't know. But he opened the door, and he said, Legionnaire Murray, Muret. So I said, you know, I grasped who he was and all the rest of it, and that he was there to receive me. And of course I said, no, we. And so there they formed up on either side of me and marched me off to the barracks in Toul, where I remained 4 days. Before, with another dozen or so, we entrained again.
Had anybody... Nobody else had been on this train,
no.
Had they, in any other part of it?
No.
There
might have been passengers.
Yes.
I'm sure there were civilians. Mm-hmm. Quite sure there were civilians. You know, vaguely I remember people moving about, but not in that particular vicinity of my carriage, my compartment. Mm. And so off we
How
were.
How long did that journey take, sir?
I've got no idea.
Must have been 18 hours or something. I don't know.
I think it must be 200 miles.
To Toul?
Yeah.
From Saint-Eyre, but Toul's in the south of France, isn't it?
No. Toul is Middle East. Eastern side.
Oh, okay, right.
You see, it's on the
All
east.
Right, okay. Towards Metz?
Murray.
Okay. Okay, Saint-Omer towards Metz.
Well, between Metz and Lyon, if you like. Going that way.
Okay, fine.
Down towards the Swiss frontier.
Okay, right.
I suppose, if I remember rightly.
And it's 200 miles or something as opposed to No, I thought it was incorrectly. I thought it was in another place. So you're greeted off the train, and they were
legionnaires,
legion people.
Yes,
right.
And so off we went to Toul.
Right, and they took you off the train, and what happened after that?
Well. One legionnaire on either side and the sergeant there just in front. He might have been behind. And off we marched to the barracks at Toul. And I can't remember anything about it, except that there were a few more legionnaires, that it was squalid, that the food was awful, there was beer to drink, which we had to pay for. And I only had English money, so I was probably robbed there. But there were about a dozen of us. And after the third or after the fourth day, we entrained at Toul for Marseilles.
Okay.
And, you know, doing that sort of thing in the middle of the summer, and you haven't had much rest, you're thinking, you're wondering whether or not you've done a foolish thing.
Exactly, yeah.
And so the incidental happenings, you know, on the train and that sort of thing, were we in a locked compartment? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I know that we were escorted, that there were still, there was two legionnaires with us and a sergeant. Mm-hmm. There was about a dozen of us, and we got to Marseille station and marched down to the Canabière and along there to the Fort St. Nicholas.
Okay. What were the other chaps who were there with you to join up? What were they like?
Well, most of them were German, if I remember, I'm sure. Yes, most of them were German, and they, you know, we weren't really on speaking terms. Not
so
really.
No common language?
No, no.
You didn't speak any German?
No, I didn't have any German then.
No. What did you learn?
And they didn't have any French, certainly not. And the it was, I've got a feeling that it was a sergeant, a German sergeant, who was only interested in the Germans.
Okay. So
But I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was full of my own thoughts, really.
Right. And but what was your motivation? I know the adventure.
That's all it was.
Really?
Absolutely nothing else. And honestly, when I spoke to Roland at the Hoban restaurant, that's when it happened. It just happened that Saturday morning.
What did you know about the you spoke to him actually on the preceding on the Saturday before you went off. That's the first time.
That's right.
What did you know of the French Foreign Legion?
Nothing. And he put me in the picture saying it was a band of rogues and all the rest of it, you know. But it was, you know, it was exciting, and bank robbers and murderers and killers and all the rest of it. He said, and he's a Frenchman.
Right.
And he said it was a place of ill repute, you know, and that I shouldn't go. Here was I, with a good job, you know, on the way up to management. And no, be absolutely silly to go. But he, had I read? I can't remember even reading Beaugest.
Yeah.
You see, I suppose I'd seen one or two films about it. And I'm quite sure that, I mean, I was, you know, at grammar school and that sort of thing, we did hear things about. And then the Boy's Own paper was my favourite paper in those days. And so I, you know, I suppose I'd read about it, probably seen it on films, but I had no real knowledge of the Foreign Legion.
What about the girlfriend in Dagenham at that time?
By this time I've got a. Was it that time? No, no, I'd already had a lovely, lovely girlfriend. In Chingford.
I mentioned it, yes.
Chingford. She was wonderful. She lived next door to my uncle. But my uncle one day came along to... He found out that I'd been going next door for tea.
Yes.
And he'd absolutely forbidden me to do so. And he'd, as a matter of fact, he'd ringed his garden in Chingford with railway sleepers so you can see what they were like, right around, I mean.
Why was that?
And he'd forbidden me to speak to the people next door. And I asked why, and he said, never you mind, just, you know, ordering me.
Yes.
I mean, he was military, do you see? He had his moustache up there. And what's more, he was practically communist. He was on the 38 bus from Chingford to Victoria. And he
does that mean? He was a driver, or?
You know, he was a conductor.
Conductor.
And he was the shop steward, you see. Of the Victoria Station, probably, at least for the 38 bus. So he was a, you know, he was a bit of a character that way, and he had these swirling up RAF moustaches, you see, moustachios, and eventually I got the story from the people next door, because when he was away, I was bored in this big house in Chingford, and especially with the fence around. And so I decided to start smoking. I'd never smoked before in my life. Never. And here am I, do you see, 17 years old. And so I went out and I bought a pipe and tobacco, top of the road. And it was nut brown flake or nut brown. No, not brown tobacco, which was one of the cheapest, you know. And so I started smoking that. And came 9 or 10 o'clock, and I was alone in the house, you see. And I dashed out into the garden, and I was as sick as a dog, you know. It was awful, awful. And I spewed me guts out against one of these blooming sleepers, you see. And a voice from next door, over these sleepers, you see, said, can I be of any help? And so I said, no. You know, grumbling, I wasn't going to have anything to do with them. I'd practically given my word. But it was awful. And eventually I went to bed, washed my mouth out and my teeth and went to bed. And I suppose I slept all right. And the next morning I was out in the garden, you know, sweeping up the vomit, getting rid of it. And a voice came over the fence again. Now, I assure you're all right. And such a lovely voice. And I said, well, thank you very much, you know, for inquiring. No, I'm quite all right. I got a bit of a headache. I told her why. Started smoking. And so, the voice said, well, oh, from upstairs window, I could see these two girls. I'd seen these two girls on a swing in the garden.
Right.
And one of them was about my age and really lovely. And the other one was a bit younger and quite attractive too. And so, but she said, perhaps you'd like to come and have a bat of lunch with us or a cup of tea. So they're a quandary. And so I said, well, it's very kind of you, you know, but I'm not supposed to come over there. So never mind about that, you know, do come and have lunch with us. And so I went and had lunch. And there was this tall gentleman who had a good job, and there was this slender lady with spectacles, and then these two daughters who were lovely. And so I had a meal with them. And, we got on extremely well. And that evening, the same evening, they got me in again, you see, for an evening meal. And then the gentleman got onto the piano, and his wife sang. And the elder daughter played the violin, and I sang, you see, and we went through all the old ones, you know, all the old songs, and we had a lovely, lovely time, with the result that I had most of my meals there, you see, for the fortnight or so that my uncle was away. And I got the story later on that my cousin, who's now departed, he died young, he used to limp, and he had a brace on his leg. Mm.
This is the one who was the bus man.
That's right, his son.
Ah, right, his son.
His son.
Right.
And he'd gone with them to the Dardanelles in Gallipoli. And I suppose, well, he was 5 or 6 years old then, maybe 7. Mm. And apparently when he was born, they were having another evening next door of music and singing.
Yes.
But, I mean, no drinking. I mean, yes. they wouldn't drink. Maybe they had a glass of wine occasionally, but they were not drinkers, and they used to go to the Methodist church, as a matter of fact. And apparently they'd... Because my cousin was born with a gammy leg, my uncle and aunt blamed it on the noise that was coming from next door.
Good gracious.
Farcical. I mean, so stupid.
Yeah.
And that's why I was forbidden to go next door. Right.
Okay.
So they come back, and I go to the Hoban, and I'm playing cricket at Walthamstow with the Hoban and Frascati.
Yes.
It might have been with the fire service, because my brother went into the fire service too. And but I'm sure it was at the Hoban and Frascati that we played at Walthamstow. Mm. And I happened to leave my cricket boots there.
Yes.
At this house next door to my uncle. The next day, early morning, Sunday, do you see, I came. I was with Sainsbury's then. That's why I was at Walthamstow. Mm. And I'd left my kit there.
Yes.
And I went on this early Sunday morning to pick my kit up. And when I came out, there's Pritchard, my cousin, sees me coming out of the door, and he looked, you know, and immediately dashed back in to, you know, to his house. And I said, oh, cat's out of the bag. Might as well, you know, get it sorted out. I had my bicycle there.
Yes.
Might as well get it sorted out. And so I went next door, and I told them, you know, the, how kind they'd been and all the rest of it. And they said, you know, well, never speak to us again. Don't speak to us again, you know, all the rest of it. And my uncle wasn't there, as a matter of fact, but I told his wife, Aunt Maud, whose father had had big timber concessions in Vladivostok.
Really?
You know, in...
Well, before the revolution. I suppose. I don't think they're giving much away
probably
after.
Afterwards.
Really?
Oh, no, well, before then.
Before.
Before. About that time.
Yes.
You know, just before 1900 or just after. And so she was a bit funny, but she was a concert pianist.
Uh-huh. Okay. You, it says on the, one of the things that you've shown me, it says working for the party. What was that about?
Ah, working for the Tory party.
Ah.
That was up in Newcastle.
Oh, right.
You see, when my father and mother, they used to put on whist drives and bridge parties and all the rest of it, you see, for the local Conservatives.
Right.
And I used to do the posters.
Okay.
And go up there, and then they'd put a dance on.
Right.
And I used to go up there and play the banjo.
Right.
Okay. So it was, that was the party.
I see, okay. So should we go on to...
not that it's ever been recognised by a Tory government or a Labour government, really, any of that.
Which?
Well, working for the party.
Oh, yes.
And so that was it, yes.
Right.
And so playing cricket, never darken our door again.
This was... right.
But I was working for Sainsbury's in Walthamstow.
And then you moved up to Hampstead.
And a few years, but a few days afterwards, yes. My uncle came along. And he said, if ever I see you going in there again, he said, I'll cut your throat.
Seemed to me, did he mean it?
Or? At the time, I really felt that he meant it. And I think that was probably why I asked for a transfer to Northwest London, to Bromsberry.
Right.
And I moved to Bromsberry. And I was very happy there. It was a very, very busy shop, Kilburn and Bromsberry. And there's another Sainsbury's just down the road. In those days, of course, Sainsbury's were specifically London. Mm. They hadn't gone further afield. And it was a good job, considered a good job. It was clean. And
and you lived in Hampstead?
And lived over the shop.
You lived over the shop?
Lived over the shop. Right. And had our meals over the shop. But I used to get on the bicycle.
Yes.
And go back to Chingford.
Really?
To see my girlfriend next door.
That take you several hours.
Straight round the North Circular Road. Oh, no.
Really?
No, hour, perhaps.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was young. And I had, during one of the Christmas periods in
Sainsbury's... I don't think you could do it from Bromsberry to Chingford in a taxi in an hour.
Very true. I remember doing from Sainsbury's up to Newcastle.
Right.
On the bicycle.
Bicycle? Yep. How long did that take?
24 hours.
And you stopped it on the road?
I stopped at York for a cup of tea, a mug of tea. That's all. It's over 300. It was 300 miles. I mean, it's 300 miles.
But you didn't stop. You didn't actually.
No, I didn't stop.
Stay
anywhere.
On route.
I stayed on for 24 hours cycling
on the bicycle.
Mm.
Good gracious! Did that take a long
most
time
of the
to
night.
Get over?
Most of the night.
Did that take a long time to get over?
I came back by train.
That answers the question, does it?
But,
why did you do that? To see whether you could do it or what?
No, once again, this is the adventure spirit coming out, you see.
Okay. All right.
Even at that time, you see. And even flaunting his orders, perhaps, was the taste of adventure and all that sort of thing. And going with this girl next door, you know, despite his orders.
Yes. Okay, shall we... You're in Marseilles.
Yes, I'm in Marseilles.
In civilian clothes still?
Yes.
Right. So what happened after that?
Well, I can remember the place we went into, and they had, there were a dozen of us went up there, perhaps more, as a matter of fact, and we went up into this big hall, and there on trestle tables were uniforms, knee breeches, more or less. Knee breeches, and no putties at that time. Mm-hmm. We didn't get putties until Sidi Bel Abbes. Mm-hmm. And jackets, mm-hmm. and callows, forage caps. Mm-hmm. No belts or anything. Mm-hmm. Braces, yes, braces. And boots.
Mm.
socks.
They were all there, you know, on the table. And so you went along and there was somebody behind and, you know, suggesting this pile and that pile and all the rest of it. And so eventually I was kitted out, more or less, and the trousers, of course, well, they were just hanging loose below the knees. And it was in khaki, light khaki, you know,
all summer. Right. So what was the formalities did you have to go through? Medicals and signing the paper?
All medicals and all the rest of it, you see, were there again. We'd already... I think we had a medical at Toul.
Okay.
But I can't remember very clearly.
And Toul was a Foreign Legion recruiting base.
Yes. Right. An engagement centre.
Okay.
You know,
right.
Station.
And how long did you spend at Fort Nicolas?
I'm sure about a fortnight, 10 days.
Right.
10 days.
Did they make you do physical jerks and so forth?
No. They were building a foyer, a naffy.
Naffy.
And this was, I mean, there were at least, shall we say, 150 steps, these old stone steps that went back to the Napoleonic Wars, and wet and damp, you know, because it's very close to the sea, the quayside there, and right up to the top, where there was a bit of a plateau.
Okay.
And there they were going to build the naffy.
Right. Okay. And that's.
And so down from the quayside.
Right.
We had to carry these great big boulders, stones, right up these 150 steps, right to the top, and they were very, very slippery and worn in the middle. I can see them, you know, now. And that was really hard work, especially as I was what they call a plumitif, a pen pusher.
Okay.
You see, I hadn't been engaged in manual work, and so my hands and fingers really, you know, the stones and boulders took their toll on my hands. But eventually, you know, I started getting used to it. It was, I joined up in the Legion. This was the Legion, and I was going to do it, you know. And my French was getting better every day. There were lots of, I can't remember, there was one German called Stern who spoke English because he'd been in Canada for a while. And then there was Ross. But there was particularly a bloke called Reist, Dutchman. My number was 71824, and his was... Now, where did we get our numbers? I'm sure it was at... I can't remember. Probably at City Blabes later on. But I'm not sure where we got our number. But in any case, I was 71824, and he was 71823, was Reist, this Dutchman, and he spoke excellent English. And so, if ever I was at a loss for words... Then Raist was there to help me. And I owe quite a lot to Raist, as a matter of fact.
So, after that, what happened? You got shipped out?
Wait a minute. We're building this foyer.
Right.
Well on with this foyer, or this naffy up at the top on the plateau, when suddenly one day, after about 10 days, we were called up there, and there were civilians, quite a number of civilians there. And this is a regular thing. When a detachment of the Legion is going to... recruits is going to City Blabes. On the last day, they call in civilians to buy the civilian clothes that we've, you know, disposed of, if you
right.
like. As we're in more or less military, quasi-military uniform now, we no longer require our civilian clothes. And if we have civilian clothes by our bedside, if you like, then we could desert, do you see,
yes.
or run away. So the civilians are called in, and our effects were auctioned. And I think we got, a minimum price for them. And, you know, we got a number of francs that were given to us. And we signed a chit, you know, saying that we'd handed in, you know, trousers and a jacket and a shirt. And had received so much money for it. You see, and that was the end of it. So it was more or less above board. But, and then after that, and then suddenly one day, of course, they had room on the Gouverneur Général de Guédon, which was one of the steamers
yes.
flying across to Oran.
Yes.
And I suppose that day they didn't have any cattle. Maybe every Tuesday they didn't have any cattle. They had room for legionnaires down, you know, on
yes.
the fourth floor, fourth deck or something
right.
like that.
Right. And so what, you travelled in the hold?
And so we travelled in the hold across to Oran.
How many of you were there then? Still 12 or more?
I think there were about a couple of dozen. And we got to Oran. And there we disembarked. And there was an officer, a captain, I found out later on. He was a captain.
The passage was not very pleasant.
Well, not down there. We didn't know whether it was pitching or rolling. I suppose we felt it like. But, it was stagnant down there. There wasn't no breath of air except through the...
So it's still more or less summertime now, is it?
And it's still, yes, it's still May, do you see?
May, right.
It's still May. I think I'd probably started out at the end of April from London. But the date I signed in Saint-Omer was the 12th of May. Yeah. Okay. And proof of it. And so, where are we? Oh, yes. And so we landed Oran, and there was a captain asking if there were any Americans or British. It was Captain Hamilton.
Right.
Captain Hamilton. And he was an American.
But in the Legion?
In the Legion, yes. And he was in charge of the post, the Legion post, at Oran, which was there. Well, in Oran they had a few legionnaires to do a patrol to see if there were any deserters or anything like that. You see, trying to catch
out
a boat.
Town patrol.
Around town patrol.
I was under the impression that foreigners very rarely got to be officers in the Legion. I thought only one or two in recent times. That's the impression I had.
No. Nope. In fact, in my day, in 1937, the majority were foreigners, really.
The majority of officers were foreign?
Up to captain.
Up to captain.
But beyond captain, from major on, they have to be become naturalized French.
I see. Okay.
Official French, and so there he was, Captain Hamilton. Then we got onto a train, and 100 miles.
What was his manner? He addressed people in French.
Oh yes, he spoke French, but he didn't have much to do really. He spoke to the officers.
What sort of atmosphere was it? Was it the come on, get this done, or bellowing.
Bellowing and pushing and shoving,
right.
And lots of this.
Quite a
Because there were quite a number who, there were Spaniards, although most of them, yes, in Oran, of course, but quite a lot of Spaniards and Germans, and I suppose that only about 25% spoke French fluently at the time, or even, or had a knowledge of French. And so I'm sure that the NCOs were German. The most part,
right?
You see, and bellowing and shouting.
What was the lingua franca? Was it always French, or were
French.
And blokes amongst themselves? The NCOs.
No, the Germans. Once they got together, of course, it was German.
German, yes.
It was German.
And so you were now. Then what happened? You got ready to
onto the train, because the captain didn't have anything to do. Really, he spoke with. I suppose there must have been officers with us. Probably a couple of officers, and so he would speak to the officers, a couple of lieutenants. Although I can't remember, and told them what time the train was leaving, you see, and organise a cask route, which was a sandwich,
right.
And a cup of coffee or something like this. And he would have organised that, but he didn't have anything to say. I was pointed out by one of the lieutenants, I suppose, or by somebody, as being English. And he came and we had words together, but very, very few.
I see. He was quite nice, or?
Oh, yes, indeed. Really a gent, really.
Right.
Lovely person. I met him later on.
Really?
When he came down to St. Bernabes, you see, I met him.
And did you know that joining the Foreign Legion meant that, presumably, that it meant winding up in North Africa? Presumably, I suppose.
Oh, yes. But I was looking forward to the Sahara Desert, you see. That was where my adventure was. The Sahara Desert, having seen films, Cary Grant and Marlene Dietrich, see.
And what? So you're on the train then, going to Sidi Bel Abbes.
Sidi Bel Abbes, yes. I think it's about 60, 80 miles. Mm. It was uneventful. The band, there was a band or the clique. Drummers and trumpets and fifes were waiting for us at the station, outside the station at Sidi Bel Abbes, which is a very small station. We got off and... by this time, of course, we know that we had to sort of form up in threes, and so we marched up with the clique, they call it, in front of us, and marched down to the, which is about a couple of miles down to right. the, 2 or 3 miles down to the down to the barracks.
And you've got only, I mean, a small just shaving kit or something, one set of uniform, more or less.
Oh, there was a coiffeur at Marseilles. There was a coiffeur to. Oh yes, that's a point I haven't pointed out yet. I mean, I had civilian up to Marseilles. I had civilian hair, didn't I? But once in Marseilles, do you see, straight into the coiffeur's, and there he is, and you sit down there, and he's doing two at a time, you know, with his electric shavers.
He's got one electric shaver in each hand.
In each hand.
And he's doing these blokes.
Two at a time.
Scalping them, basically.
Yes, indeed, everything off. Right. Although I'd had the same thing, but one at a time down in Caterham.
Ah, okay. Okay, it's just about the end of this tape.